Hi, everybody. On 88.1, it's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Glad you're with us. David Linden is a neuroscientist at the Johns Hopkins School of Medicine and the former editor of the Journal of Neurophysiology. David has written several terrific books about our brains and how they work. His first book, The Accidental Mind, explored how our brains evolved over time to make us capable of things like romantic love and belief in God. In a book called The Compass of Pleasure, he argues that we are hardwired to seek pleasure in a variety of forms. And in both of those books, he writes about the inextricable link between our minds and our hearts. Last January, David published his latest book, in which he takes up the subject of touch. And again, he proposes that the many ways in which we experience touch, from a tender caress to a painful injury, are all tied in one way or another to our emotions. The book is called Touch, The Science of Hand, Heart, and Mind. He joined me in the studio in February to talk about this fun and fascinating read. And a note to listeners with children nearby, we did talk a little bit about sex. And right at the beginning of the book, David Linden makes the case that of all of our senses, touch may be the most essential. Having a sense of touch is simply not optional.
I think we tend to discount touch because we can't imagine it not being there. We can close our eyes and imagine being blind, and we can plug our ears and imagine being deaf, and we can pinch our nose shut, but you can't turn off your touch sense. And it's true. So if a child is born blind, they can develop and have a normal mind, normal brain, normal body. Same if you're born deaf, you can have a great life. But if you're born with a sense of touch, but you are deprived of loving touch as a newborn and a toddler, as happened in Romanian orphanages in the 1980s and 90s, well, then a complete disaster unfolds.
Yeah, they actually have physical symptoms later in life. I mean, they have gastrointestinal problems, and they have psychological developmental problems. I mean, it's really severe, isn't it?
Yeah, it's quite severe, and the bad news is that it doesn't go away as you grow up. So these kids who didn't receive loving touch early in life, they develop self-soothing, compulsive rocking motions and attachment disorders. Their growth is slowed. Their cognitive development is reduced. But then, as adults, when we track them, they have high incidences of obesity, schizophrenia, obsessive compulsive disorder, immune system dysfunction. Touch is not optional for early human development the way the other senses are.
And it's interesting, you observe that metaphors about touch really pervade our rhetoric. We talk about, you know, being touched by her kindness, or he rubs me the wrong way. I mean, we have these phrases that actually, relate directly to what things feel like on our skin.
Well, that's right. And we're so used to using them, we don't even think about them as having to do with touch at all. When we say my feelings to mean my tender emotions, there is a reason why it's my feelings and not my sightings or my smellings. I mean, this seems silly. And it seems, I think some of your listeners might say, well, but this is just a trick of modern day English. Who really cares that at this moment in time, in this one language, we happen to use that metaphor? But it's not just a trick of modern day English. In English, it's been around as long as we have recorded English, back to the 13th century. And we know that the constructions like I'm touched or my feelings are present in many languages, not just languages even of the Indo-European language group.
David Linden, the new book is called Touch, The Science of Hand, Heart, and Mind. I'm Tom Hall on 88.1. You're listening to Maryland Morning with Sheila Cast. So you talk about touch being intrinsically emotional. What does that mean?
Well, what it means, and this is a rather remarkable discovery, it turns out that if we look in our brains, we have two different streams of information coming from all the touch receptors, which are different kinds of nerve endings in our skin, some for heat and cold and pain and itch and vibration and texture and all these different things. And they go to our brain, and then we have two centers. One of them is there to just give us the facts of touch. Where on my body am I being touched? In what fashion? How intensely? And there's a completely separate region of the brain called the posterior insula that's involved in giving touch its emotional tone. It's what makes pain feel emotionally bad. It's what makes a caress or an orgasm feel emotionally good. And we think of these things as being intrinsic properties of pain or caress or orgasm. But that's just a trick our brain plays on us by having the fact analysis and the emotional analysis of touch happening at the same time.
So you say that all sensations, including touch, are in the service of action, right? So they're not reporting on the outside world, but they're making inferences about what to expect from the outside world.
That's right. So our senses are not built to give us the lowdown. They're not built to give us the most accurate representation of the external world at all. As a result of our human experience and as a result of lots of evolutionary history, our senses cherry pick the data from the outside world to feed to us. Then, before we are ever conscious of it, they blend it with expectations about how the world works and with our emotions. So there is no sensation without emotion. Let me give you an example, right? If you like tea and you like coffee, and you pick up your mug and you're expecting coffee and you get a sip of tea, your experience of that at that moment is very, very different than if you were expecting tea and you got tea.
Yeah. And this business of the outside world and the touch that we experience from outside and the touch that we experience that's self-generated is interesting. We can't tickle ourselves. And self-inflicted pain is somehow less painful than pain inflicted by somebody else. Why is that?
Well, it's part of a general theme. In our brains, we're hardwired to discount sensations that result from our own movements, our own actions. And it happens in all senses. But just imagine walking down the street. You're walking down the street, you're swinging your limbs, and your clothes are moving against your body, but you don't even think about that. You don't even notice it. Yet, if you were still and then your clothes moved against your body in that same way, suddenly you would be saying, oh, who's groping me? What's going on? You'd be very attentive to it. And so when you go to tickle yourself, your brain is sending commands to the muscles in your arm and in your fingers to make the tickling motion. But a copy of that command is also going to the part of the brain called the cerebellum. And from there, it is inhibiting the part of your brain that feels the touch sensation and damping it down. And that damping is why we can't tickle ourselves unless you have damage to your cerebellum, which interrupts that dampening circuit.
And you talk about some cases in which that is the case, in which patients report that. Yeah.
Right. It can happen with cerebellar damage. It can also happen in a subset of schizophrenics as well, possibly also because of cerebellar damage.
And all the sensations, including touch, are interrelated, right? So touch is just as interrelated to the others. I mean, you talk about how the context of touch really matters. I mean, if someone gives you a shoulder squeeze, if that's your boss coming up behind you in your cubicle, that's one thing. If it's your lover, at dinner, that's another thing. So the context, the social context of how and by whom we're touched matters a lot.
Oh, it matters enormously. And I think the important thing to realize, imagine this, do this mental exercise. You're with your sweetheart, you're feeling good, connected, loving, and your sweetheart puts his or her arm around you and gives you a squeeze. Now imagine the very same squeeze from the very same person, identical, the same place on your skin, the same pressure, but now it's in the middle of an argument and it's not resolved. Well, that feels totally differently. And it's not just that it feels the same, but then you think about it differently, it actually feels differently. And the reason it does is because the higher areas of the brain that are involved in computing social context are sending messages to the somatosensory cortex, the part of the brain that actually creates the feeling, and changing that.
So the fourth chapter of the book is called Sexual Touch. And I'll admit, David, you had me at sexual. You did. Mm-hmm. So let's talk a little bit about the hardwires that we all have and then how that can perhaps even dictate our preferences in bed. You quote Naomi Wolf from a book she wrote called Vagina, A Cultural History. Is it true that we are sort of hardwired, our preferences in bed are somewhat hardwired and predetermined?
In truth, we don't know. So Naomi Wolf made a hypothesis, which is a reasonable one, and she pointed out that if you look at autopsy tissue, for example, of women, you find that the innervation of the genitals is not precisely the same from woman to woman. Some women might have a few more fibers in their clitoris and less in their cervix, some more in their labia, some more in their vagina, some more around the anus or the rectum. And so she hypothesizes, and this is a reasonable guess, maybe that variation has something to do with people's individual sexual likes and dislikes, and could be the same for men, who also aren't precisely hardwired in that innervation. But the truth is we don't know. And the reason is because these nerves are very small. They're too small for medical scanning machines. And so we can't just interview people about what they like in bed and then take a picture of their genitals and see how it correlates. We have cadavers, and most of the time we don't have interviews with people before they died asking what they liked in bed. So it's a reasonable guess. I think it's almost certain that a large aspect of people's sexual likes and dislikes are not heritable and not anatomical. It's an open question whether a part of it is.
How about broadly speaking, men and women? Do we experience touch differently?
We experience touch a little bit differently. If you're talking about sexual touch, it's actually remarkable how similar it is. So there was this great study where they asked men and women to write descriptions of their orgasms. And then people were hired to take out all the, you know, words like penis and vagina that would give away whether it was a man or a woman. And then these descriptions were given to people to read, students or doctors or psychologists, sex therapists. Nobody could tell a difference between which was a male and which was a female orgasm. And the same thing is true if you do brain scanning. If you do brain scanning in men and women while they're having an orgasm, there are only very subtle differences that you find. The pattern of activation is remarkably similar.
I really don't want to ask you how one does brain scanning of people while they're having an orgasm. Are there in fact studies that have happened like that?
Well, you know, not surprisingly, most of these studies are done in the Netherlands.
I see.
And
leave it to them.
It's a deeply unsexy situation.
One would imagine.
You know, your head, you have to think about it. Your head is strapped down because your brain can't jiggle. You have an IV in your arm to inject the radioactive water. You have a probe in your tuchus. It's not a romantic scene at all. And then there's some geek like me in a white coat with a clipboard staring at you.
Yeah, just in time for Valentine's Day, ladies and gentlemen, a new idea. You talk about how social touch reinforces cooperation and loyalty. I'm fascinated by a study they did with the National Basketball Association, finding that players who do celebratory touches, you know, chest bumps and stuff, early in the season, actually that's associated with higher win streaks and, win percentages later in the season. That's interesting.
Yeah, that's great. So this was a terrific study done at Berkeley by Dr. Keltner's group. And they got people to score all these NBA games. And it's just as you said, where there was more, they scored the butt pats and the high fives and the chest bumps and the high tens and all the things that people do to celebrate. And they found not only did the teams that celebrated more early in the season do better later, but when you analyzed their play, they played in a more team-like manner. In other words, a player who might have a poor shot but a chance at it would be more likely to pass off to his teammate who had a better shot rather than hogging the glory for themselves.
You talk about the emotional component of pain, and you talk about a disorder in which people are what's called pain asymbolic, where they don't have an emotional resonance with pain, and that can actually lead to all sorts of problems. And we're running out of time, but is there a way to attenuate pain? Is there a way to lessen one's sense of pain?
Well, you can, for chronic pain, you can lessen it with obviously with drugs, but more interestingly with practices like open presence meditation. There's a positive feedback loop between chronic pain and anxiety. And if you can break that loop with processes that reduce anxiety, both pharmacologic and behavioral, then you can do a lot of good.
Yeah, well, it's fascinating stuff. Thanks for coming in. Appreciate it, as always.
Thanks for having me on. It was fun.
David Linden, he's a neuroscientist at the Johns Hopkins School of Medicine and the former editor of the Journal of Neurophysiology. His latest book is called Touch, The Science of Hand, Heart, and Mind. We spoke last February. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.